All right, our next case is State v. Alvarado. Again, State v. Alvarado. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. While a criminal trial is not a game in which the participants are expected to enter the ring with a near match in skills, neither is it a sacrifice of unarmed prisoners to gladiators. That's a comment from Justice Stevens, who was quoting Judge Wozinski in the court case of United States versus Chronic. And I think that I start off my argument with that because I think that in this case, in Mr. Alvarado's case, I believe that we have an instance here where we have just this situation that has taken place, and that I'm asking you for some extraordinary relief. And that relief is to take a look at the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal and to make a determination that my client received ineffective assistance of counsel and that he should be granted at least, at minimum, a new trial, if not to have the case overturned based upon the evidence that was presented. As to those claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, and one of the reasons I make this argument first of ineffective assistance of counsel is that during this entire trial, there were only 8 objections that were made by trial counsel for Mr. Alvarado to any evidence that was submitted. Actually, none of that was made to any evidence. It was only those objections were only made to some witness testimony that was made. 6 of those objections were sustained based upon hearsay grounds. 2 of them were overruled. Bottom line is, none of the evidence that was presented at trial was given any kind of controversy or any kind of testing done or envisioned by the Sixth Amendment to make sure that we had an adversarial proceeding that was taking place here. And that's why I think that in under United States versus Chronic, I believe that this is a case that fits that example and fits an ability for you to be able to make a decision that there was an effective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. First of all, there were 3 trial stipulations that were entered into by trial counsel for Mr. Alvarado. The first was exhibit number 1, which was regarding herpes testing. The second was exhibit number 2, which was regarding urine samples and a chain of custody. And exhibit number 3 was the same kit and its chain of custody.
Isn't it typical, though, in criminal trials to stipulate as to chain of custody, simply to shorten the trial?
It can be. However, usually when you're doing that, the appellant is getting something for that. And let me tell you, in none of this, did Mr. Alvarado get anything for his deal of stipulating to these chain of custody. And in fact, on the urine samples, both of the police officers testified, and they could have easily been asked about the chain of custody, and it wouldn't have taken that much of court time to have answered that. I believe that it was important for the chain of custody to have been done on the same kit because I think that there were issues about the chain of custody there. And I believe that on the herpes testing, I believe that first of all, if there would have been some objection to that, that perhaps maybe that would have been too prejudicial and some of that would have been kept out. And also, I think that it's especially on the herpes testing, it seems unfathomable to me, as a defense attorney with 19 years of experience, that I would ever allow or stipulate to some kind of information like that coming in against my client without having some sort of objection to it or some motion in limine or some challenge to that evidence.
So would the objection simply have been 403?
Well, the objection would have been 403. I think that would have been one of the objections, but there was no objection that was made towards any of this. And this was simply stipulated to and allowed to come in based upon the agreement of the party. And trial counsel there was no benefit to the appellant to allow this kind of inflammatory testimony to come in against him when there was no testimony establishing foundation about who had the herpes. There was no the Testing results were totally inconsistent. They were not the same test results that were done on the appellant that was done on the alleged victim. They were two completely different test results, and it allowed Dr. Taylor to go on and on at trial, which didn't save the appellant anything as far as testimony goes, as to the issue of herpes and any of that inflammatory information that came towards the jury based upon that information. That, I think, is where there was ineffective assistance of counsel towards those stipulations, especially the stipulation about the herpes information, and I think that it was ineffective assistance of counsel, and I believe that it was ineffective that my client, that the trial counsel allowed that to come in on stipulation.
Can you expand on your assertion that they were two very different herpes test results?
Sure. One of the herpes test results quantifies the amount of herpes virus that was present in Mr. Alvarado. The other one just tested whether the herpes was present or not. And I think first of all, that is very very damaging. I think that Dr. Taylor testified at trial about how much he made testimony about how much herpes virus was available, about how quickly the infection would spread based upon how much herpes virus was available. Perhaps there was another explanation. Perhaps the alleged victim is the person who had the herpes virus here and could have infected Mr. Interiano with the Alvarado with the herpes virus.
So you're suggesting if there's more virus in the victim, that would have been telling?
Well, I think it could have been. I think it was information that certainly should have been available to the jury. If that information was going to be presented, it should have been presented fairly. And I think that was a severe mistake on behalf of counsel to have allowed that to come in when it was two completely different test results. It's apples and oranges. You're saying yes or no versus a quantitative result. I think that's a major difference. Excuse me.
While you take this little break, let me ask you
yes.
a question. One of the issues that you raised on the sufficiency of the evidence is whether there was penetration or not.
Yes.
Would you agree with us that State versus Smith from this year now answers that question?
I'm sorry, but I'm not familiar with State versus Smith case. I think that I don't know, unless you want to enlighten me about what the holding
State
was.
Well, State versus Smith basically said that touching between the lips of the vagina is sufficient to establish penetration.
Okay.
I think the testimony from the victim here was when she woke up in the morning, his fingers were between the vagina, or between the lips of her vagina.
Well, I think that what we need to do in this case is go back to the original testimony of the victim here, who said that when she was originally interviewed that penetration didn't take place. The only time she said penetration took place is after she had been prepped by counsel, by the prosecutor. Then she decided to change her story and say that penetration took place.
Which I think we need credibility for the jury to determine.
Well, it certainly is an issue of credibility. However, I think when you couple it with all the other things, I think, again, that's an issue. I think that's an issue that I still think that penetration didn't take place. I still think that's a matter of law, not a question of fact necessarily for the jury to be a purvey. I think the other thing is that I think when it comes down to it, the evidence was not sufficient to uphold the verdict based upon the story of the alleged victim. And also, I think in the very end, the sentence was an abuse of discretion here in this situation. The appellant was an absolute law-abiding person. He had letter upon letter in his pre-sentence investigation that said what an upstanding person he was, that this kind of a crime was something that was completely out of character for him. That there was no brutality by the sane examination to her vaginal area or rectal area of the alleged victim in this case. The only bad act that my client did was he professed that he was innocent, and he still professes his innocence to this day. And I don't believe that that's a standard that should be allowed to be have someone extra punished for, and I think that he was extra punished in this case. Because I think if you look at how the time that he received here, while it is within the statutory realm. Bottom line is, I still think it was an abuse of discretion. And you know, the only thing the appellant did to the alleged victim was he asked her to stay, and he told her how beautiful she was. Those are the only two things that he did. She had a recollection of being at the kitchen table with him, that there was no being held against her will. And I think under that situation, I don't think that that's somebody that warrants 25 to 35 years of their life for a situation that I think it was consensual. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Von Lo. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Counsel.
I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant has assigned numerous claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, challenges the sufficiency of the evidence to support his conviction, as well as claims he received an excessive sentence. The state believes appellant's assigned errors are without merit, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. I'll begin by addressing some of appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Appellant started off with his argument that counsel was ineffective under the standard established by Cronic. The state disagrees. The Nebraska Supreme Court has stated that in order for counsel to be ineffective under the Cronic standard, that counsel's failure must be total. And as noted in brief here, trial counsel had a theory of the case as presented to the jury in opening statements. He elicited testimony on cross-examination of the state's witnesses to support that theory. And then during closing arguments, he argued to the jury based on his theory of the case and what the evidence revealed during the state's case in chief, as well as his cross-examination of the state's witnesses. So the state believes that he did subject the state's case to adversarial testing, and he was not ineffective under the Cronic standard.
Does the Cronic standard require him to object to some of the exhibits that were mentioned?
Your Honor, I think what's very interesting to me about some of appellant's arguments, for example, he notes, well, counsel objected only 8 times. Now, 6 of those were sustained, which I think shows that when trial counsel felt an objection was warranted, he made it. And 6 of the 8 times, based on appellant's count, he was accurate. I think appellant did not give specific examples of, well, right here, this witness testified to this, and if this objection had been made, it would have been kept out. I realize that there are certain exhibits that appellant does assign ineffective claims to, saying those should have been objected to. As noted in state's brief, we do not believe that the objections would have been sustained. We don't believe they had merit. I don't think that under any standard, counsel is required to make meritless or frivolous objections simply to show that he's objecting. So again, I think that, as mentioned, counsel had a theory of the case. He elicited testimony to support that theory, and then he made arguments based on that testimony, what the evidence showed, and his theory of the case to the jury during closing arguments.
For those exhibits that are perhaps trial strategy, are those ones we can address now?
Well, I think that this court could. I mean, I don't think that there's any evidence that the chain of custody could not have been established. There are just kind of these conclusory allegations. Well, anytime the state seeks a stipulation, it must mean that they couldn't establish it without it. And I don't think that's the case. I think here, as mentioned by this court, often as a routine matter, chain of custody is stipulated to. Again, it kind of saves some trial time, and it allows both parties to focus on really relevant issues. Not the chain of custody is not relevant, it can be, but to focus on maybe other matters in the case. I recognize this court may determine that that cannot be addressed on direct appeal. I do think that it can be based on the record before this court. I think that adequately covers the chain of custody with the urine sample and the same kit. I will turn to Exhibit 1, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim related to stipulating to the testing results that showed that both the victim and the appellant tested positive for HSV-1. First, I'll note that the test was very relevant. The victim testified that she could not remember most of what occurred from the time that she was dropped off by the Uber driver to her apartment to when she woke up the next morning. So testimony or evidence other than her testimony was going to be necessary for the state to establish that some sort of sexual contact occurred. based on the information provided to the jury by the doctor about how HSV-1 can be transferred, whether it's a person who has the infection orally, performing oral sex on someone, or skin-to-skin contact was necessary. So that information, along with the testing results and the presence of the lidocaine in the victim's urine, is circumstantial evidence that there was skin-to-skin contact between the victim's genitals and some part of the appellant. Now, appellant does argue that the tests performed on himself and the victim were two different tests. He does not appear to be arguing that his test results were incorrect and that he actually does not have HSV-1 present, and so this was a mistake. He simply argues one showed yes or no and one showed amount. And I think the type of test isn't important. What's important is that both had HSV-1 present in their system. That was what the state was trying to establish, that the victim testified that prior to, I believe it was, she either said March 18th or March 17th, she did not have herpes or genital sores or fever blisters. And then a few days after her contact with the appellant, she began to develop flu-like symptoms and these sores on her genital area. So the state believes that that test was very relevant. It helped establish that some type of intimate contact occurred.
Okay, so it may be relevant, but is it not prejudicial?
I think most evidence, you know, I think we're all familiar with the proposition that most evidence is designed to be prejudicial in some form or another. And I think, again, the key is it unfairly prejudicial? Does it suggest a decision or a verdict based on an improper basis? And commonly they say an emotional one, but it's not always that. And I think appellant's argument here is that it's so inflammatory, I believe he said, to be cause for punitive behaviors by the jury. But this is refuted by the record, because the jury acquitted appellant of one of the charges. So it didn't say, well, we've got to convict on everything because of these test results and guilty for without holding the state to its burden of proof. So I think the jury was able to evaluate the evidence. The state, we believe we met the burden of proof on both counts. The jury obviously disagreed as they acquitted. But I think that shows that this evidence was not unfairly prejudicial. So was it prejudicial? Well, it helped establish that there was contact between appellant and the victim, which was an issue in the case, but I do not believe that it was unfairly prejudicial, and I don't think appellant can show that.
And not necessarily to cut you off on the effective assistance of counsel, but can you switch gears just a little bit on the sufficiency of the evidence? In light of the fact she remembers basically nothing, how do we find lack of
Well, I think that it's lack of consent, or subsection B of 319 is that the victim was mentally or physically incapable of resisting or appraising the nature of her conduct, and the appellant knew or should have known of that fact.
And that's the question, the knew or should have known, when her own friends who she had conversations with that day didn't know she was wrong.
Well, I believe that one of her friends who discussed with her, I believe it was the friend who was with her at the party and then spoke with her later, maybe when she was at the bar, said she seemed a little spacey. Her boyfriend described her as confused when he spoke with her, and this court well remembers the victim had left her house keys locked in her car, got a ride from the Uber driver to her house, and then realized she didn't have her keys. And her boyfriend stated that when he spoke with the victim, she seemed very confused as to how he could have entered the house. She kept saying, I'm across the street.
And she was.
She was not across the street from the bar.
She was across the street from her
house. Correct. But I think the key here is that appellant was a stranger to her. I think that testimony established that. The Uber driver was also a stranger to the victim, and she stated that when the victim got in her car, she was chatty and upbeat. Then things kind of changed. She was bracing herself against the other passenger. The other passenger had to start asking multiple times for her address. When the other passenger got out, the victim, I believe she's described it as kind of sprawled across the back seat, was singing along, and that when they got to the victim's residence, the Uber driver looked back, and the victim was braced against the door, the driver had to tap her knee, call to her to get her to wake up, that the victim, in getting out of the car, had to brace herself on the door, and then walked forward. The driver described it as a zombie-like walk, that she'd walk a few steps and then drag a foot. And the Uber driver specifically described it as though she drank a bottle of cold medicine. So I think that driver, who was a stranger to the victim, was able to see when she was dropped off, hey, something's not right here. She's not acting, whether it's how she was when she got in the car, but at that point, she was acting as though she drank a bottle of cold medicine. So, I mean, we've had that experience. I guess there was no testimony about how one normally acts when they drink a bottle of cold medicine, but the driver described she was walking funny, she had to kind of brace herself, she had to be, you know, kind of shook awake. So I think that there is evidence from which the jury could and did find that she just was not there, and that another stranger to her could tell that something was wrong. And so appellant also knew or should have known of that fact. And I think going along with that, the appellant later stated that he told the girl she was going to get him into trouble. Appellant's Facebook page was up on March 18th, and the officers were able to view it. And then when they went back later that day, the page had been removed. I think that shows consciousness of guilt. So the state believes that the evidence presented was sufficient to support penetration. The victim testified that her vagina was sore for days after. Some of the DNA testing showed that there either a DNA or a sperm fraction, the appellant was a contributor to a sperm fraction found on the rectal swab of the victim, and then her DNA was found on a swab of the shaft of his penis. So we believe the evidence was sufficient to support the conviction, and I am...
I do have a question.
Yes.
What about the sentence, the 25 to 35 years? What supports that severe sentence in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think our... First, to kind of frame this, it's the standard here is an abuse of discretion. The court did not consider any inappropriate factors. I think, as the state noted in brief, the appellant, basically, I believe his statement was that the victim was saying lies. The district court noted that he is not taking full responsibility.
That's often a rub, right? When somebody's saying, I'm innocent, I did not do this, and if the court expects them to take responsibility, then they have to admit to committing the act. So that's always a rub.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think here the district court noted it had reviewed the pre-sentence investigation report, which included all of this information about appellant's history, background, character, condition. The district court, and you know, I suppose the reason that we say this is an abuse of discretion is because it would be a lot for this court, you know, this court wasn't in the position to observe the trial and all of the pretrial, the prelims, everything thereafter. So I think the reason that the district court was able to view the defendant, observe the trial, and it was also, like this court, was able to also review the pre-sentence investigation report. Again, I think that it was within the statutory limits. There is no indication that any inappropriate factors were considered by the district court, that this sentence was on an improper basis, and the state believes that the appellant cannot show an abuse of discretion. If there are no other questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much did we take her over? Would you like more time?
Here.
Okay. Very good. Thank you both very much. The matter is submitted.